Welcome to the Common Geeking Program, a veritable book club for nerd or geek culture. Anywho, it's what we do when we get four people together and one of us is me and I talk about like a thing and then three other people talk about their things and we're all nerds about it.
Can confirm.
Yeah, so anywho, today I, Austin, am your host and I am joined by...
Edward Ryan, and this week I'm going to be repping Dark Souls.
Hey, it's me, Keenan, again. You already know my last name. I will be repping Bioshock.
Ooh. Hi, my name is Jeff Levitt, or Chowder, whichever you prefer. today I'm going to be repping The Covenant of Primus, which is a Transformers lore story.
Sounds like a cult to me.
Yeah, it sounds like a cult.
It's kind of culty, yeah. Honestly.
The topic of this episode is going to be lore, as in the background knowledge of the mythology and history of whatever series of books, comics, TV shows, movies, video games, whatever we're looking at.
Medium.
And to talk about some lore, I had these kids read some of J.R.R. Tolkien's Silmarillion.
You want to back that up a bit?
Keenan, shut the fuck up.
I am of legal drinking age. I'm not a child.
I'm going to edit you out of the entire podcast.
That'll be...
in particular, the sections entitled the Ainu Lindale and the Vala Quenta.
You want to hit me with that pronunciation one more time?
Yeah, it's the Ainu Lindale and the Vala Quenta. If you looked at a physical version of the text, I mean, you obviously... I didn't
at all.
There is a pronunciation guide for his words.
Oh, good.
Here, I'm gonna check the end of this PDF and I'll see if there's a pronunciation guide.
Okay, cool. For anyone who doesn't know, the Silmarillion is Tolkien's body of lore that exists as like the mythology and history of the elves in Middle-earth, in The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings.
Good old Jolkin, Rolkin, Rolla, Tolkien, Tolkien.
I like to call him Jonald Ronald Rules Tolkien.
That's not his real name. His real name is Jolkin, Rolkin, Roll Tolkien, Tolkien.
Okay, so to summarize, each of you will take like 5 minutes to try to like recount what you think happened in it.
Oh, God. What? I mean, you're God, so you're Eru, so...
He's just trying to make it this way so that we're the first people to say the guy's name so we pronounce them way the fuck wrong. Because I was banking on the summary being told by Austin so I could learn how to pronounce people's names.
So, yeah, Eddie, can you start? What happened in the Ainu Lindale and the Vala Quenta? You got 5 minutes, and then we're switching off to Keenan.
Yeah!
Jesus, I'm crow. I'm gonna have to pronounce some stuff. Okay, all right, so, in the beginning, also don't correct my pronunciations until after. Okay, let's do it. So in the beginning, there was Eru, and he's the one true god. And I think the elves call him Iluvatar. So anyway, he's chilling in the void. He's thinking about like, hey, what if I had some thoughts? And those thoughts manifested as the Ainur. Yeah. All right. Sure.
Yeah, the Ainur.
And the Ainur were like, you know, I guess like other gods, but like lesser than Iluvatar.
The Ainus gods.
Yeah. so then he made a whole bunch of those by thinking about them. And then one day he was like, hey, I have a great idea. And he thought of like this music or like song or rhythm. And so they all started making that music. And like as like, you know, I the way it kind of read to me is like he's like slowly building like a theme, like a song. So it probably started out as like a little bit of music, maybe like one rhythm, and then he added stuff. So he's like composing it with the Ainur, and they're like making the music with their like voices, I guess.
Yeah.
And then everything's great, and they're all like, yeah, this is pretty spicy. And then there's this one guy, Melkor, and he's apparently like the strongest of the Ainur. And so he's got kind of like more individual thoughts. And he's all like, you know what? I'm going to make my own fucking music.
He starts scatting.
So he's, yeah, basically, yeah.
Sorry, that, no shit. That is how I was like, I was reading it.
The themes
and
of
that
Melkor
it,
are just scatting.
No, like, that's how I read it. It sounded like it was a sweet jazz session and everyone was jamming out. And all of a sudden, Melkor was like, scoop it up, bop, and like,
I think that's surprisingly accurate.
All the people around Melkor they were all like, whoa, what's going on? I mean, I guess we're changing the music. So they started changing the music now. Too. So it was like this huge wave of different music. And eventually it came to a head and the two themes clashed. And so then Iluvatar, he stood up and he's like, whoa. And he held up his hand and all the music stopped. And then he like started up the music again, right? And then Melkor was like, fuck you. And so he started up his music again. So the music's clashed again. And then Iluvatar stood up again and he was like, whoa, right? And so then he started like an even more powerful music and it like drowned out Melkor's music. So Melkor was pretty salty at this point. And then some time passes, I guess, or I forgot some stuff. Oh, yeah, yeah, okay. And then Iluvatar is like, hey, I have a new idea. Sound was pretty cool, but what about sight? So he like grants all the Aenir like this vision of the Arda, which is like the world, right?
Maybe.
Yeah.
I thought Ea was the world.
Sure. And then they all see it and they're all like, wow, that's really cool. And then some of them were like, that's super extra special cool.
I want it.
Conveniently, the ones that were named prior.
Well, they all had names, but we don't care about the other names.
Yeah, but the only ones that they mentioned before they started talking about the Arda were the ones that ended up going there.
Yeah, because why would the elves care about the ones that didn't go to Arda?
I don't know, man. I'm just saying, all the significant ones went to Arda.
Well, yeah, because those were, like, the first ones, so it's like they had the most, you know, Iluvatar in them, I guess. I don't know.
Also, Eddie, you've got 20 seconds left.
So then they all go, and they start creating the world, and Melkor is messing everything up, so, like, every time they're building up, like, their Lego towers, he comes and he, like, knocks them down and, like, kicks sand on them, and everyone's pretty mad at him, and then they fight him, and then he goes and hides. And that's the story.
Yeah, that's fair. So, Keenan, since now it's your turn, are there any things that you would, like, add to or amend in Eddie's explanation? Do you want to say, perchance, like, why Melkor was kicking over their Lego towers?
Well, Melkor was still pretty salty about losing that scat battle against Louis Prima there. So, like, he was trying to play it cool, but he wasn't cool about it, bro. And, like, some other guy also was like, yeah, bro, that ain't cool. Your scatting was the shit, son. He was like, oh, I know it was.
I do know why, actually. Now, maybe
I read it wrong, but I'm pretty sure they were all after, like, this flame, the eternal flame. Is that right?
The imperishable flame.
The imperishable flame. And what's his face? The big guy up there, like, put it a lot.
Did you say the mayor?
Yeah, basically the mayor.
Manway?
Manway. The most powerful of the...
No, I gotta correct a pronunciation. That's the Maiar you're talking about.
Manway, the most powerful of the Valar.
I do need to interject here for a moment. Yeah, so Jeffrey, you got it right there. These Valar, they are those 7 to 9 best Ainur, because they are like the most powerful ones, and they're special for that Ainur. And then there are also these less powerful things that came in that Keenan was calling the mayor, that are the Maiar. And they're like, they're the same kind of being, except they're less powerful.
So, like, the big guy in charge puts the imperishable flame into the world. And Melkor was all like, man, I want that flame, because I don't know, it must have been like a really nice hat.
So Melkor, he wanted to make his own stuff. Eddie, your time is up. I don't care, right? That was the thing, because everyone else was basically just making what Iluvatar thought up.
Yeah, he wanted to. Because
Iluvatar was like, hey guys, look at this cool stuff that I thought of. And everyone else was like, wow, those are great ideas, Iluvatar. We're going to make those ideas. And then Melkor was like, I want to make my own ideas.
That's true.
And then there was also the other guy. Was it Olmo?
That's something I had a problem with, like, the writing of this piece, that they would just mention names as if we knew them. They're like, and then Jeff, like, he was there, and he was pretty upset about this.
I was there.
And I'm like, oh, do we know Jeff? And they're like, oh, by the way, Jeff is this guy.
I'm pretty sure Olmo was Davy Jones.
Yeah, Olmo is Manwe's best friend.
Cool. But anyway, so, like, Manway, like, stood up against Melkor, who was looking for, like, the imperishable flame.
It was in the void, and then they put it in the center of the world.
Ah, I see.
What was that called? Was that Ea? It was, like, A-E-A, right?
Double dots.
I don't know how to pronounce that. It's, like, way.
Ea is the world that is, which is sort of, like, everything that's in existence that's not part of the void.
And oh, I thought Arda that was the flame.
What?
I thought Ea was the flame.
No. Ea, the imperishable flame is just set in the center of Ea, and, like, the world...
But Ea became when the flame was placed there, right?
Yeah, right?
I mean, like, he just sort of... Yeah, essentially.
All right, cool.
Wait, Ea's a person?
No.
No. Ea is not a person.
But you said he.
No. We were talking about Iluvatar doing stuff or Eru.
I thought, okay.
We're almost out of time for Keenan, which was taken up by Eddie. So, like, Jeff, what do you got to say about this bullshit?
What about Manuel?
A lot of that covered it. But they went to, Arda or Ea or Earth, which I'm pretty, are those all synonymous?
Arda and Earth are synonymous, but Ea also, like, includes, like, the heavens and stuff.
Yeah, the nice places.
Oh, okay. So like, yeah, like you said, a lot of the Ainur, am I pronouncing that right? Ainur?
No. There's no Enya in it. It's just Ainur.
Ainur. Okay. Ainur. A few of the Ainur went to the place Arda, right? And the ones that went to the place Arda are called the Valar,
yes.
Correct? Except for Melkor.
Well, they're all the Ainur. The Valar are a subset of Ainur that came to Arda.
Plural Ainur, singular Ainu.
Oh, okay, gotcha.
And pretty much the only ones we give a shit about.
And the Maiar are a subset of that.
No, the Maiar are a different subset of Ainur. They're just weaker ones.
Correct.
So, okay, so the Valar were all the ones that went to Arda except for Melkor. They don't call him that anymore because he's, like, on a whole different plane, right?
Yeah, they don't say his name at all anymore?
Well, they changed his name to Morgoth, which means the enemy.
Yeah.
Oh, is that where it's said in the enemy?
Yeah.
So anyway, what they took it upon themselves as their mission was, because they knew most of Iluvatar's plan, because they'd listened to the entirety of his song before they were kind of living in it, they took it upon themselves to make the wills of Iluvatar actually happen, except Melkor, who was trying to just fuck everything up.
I do have a question, real quick, about Sauron.
What about him?
Sauron was like he was created by Morgoth, right?
Yeah, no, I know what he was, but like, it said Sauron had a part and was only less evil than his master in that for long he served another and not himself. Did he stop serving Morgoth?
Melkor?
Wait, can I take my interpretation before Austin gives us the real answer?
Eddie, shoot.
So what I got that as is that So the real evil of Melkor is that he wouldn't follow Iluvatar.
Yeah.
And so Sauron is slightly less evil than Melkor because Sauron followed Melkor.
No, I understood that. My issue is that for long, like, they gave it
time.
Well, because
eventually he stopped following Melkor because Melkor, like, went away or died, I assume. But I didn't read the rest of this book, so I don't know.
I didn't know that.
Melkor kind of gets banished from Middle-earth. The Valar get sick of his shit after a while.
Wait, they weren't sick of his shit near? They were knocking over his Lego castles? He was scatting all over the place?
Yeah, why did it take long for them to get sick of his shit?
Like, kept going on about how this is your dad's music, you know?
Yeah, but the thing is, like, their dad didn't tell them to fucking beat the shit out of Melkor, so they were just like, we'll just sort of defeat him and try to get this good stuff to happen instead of focusing on, like, killing Melkor.
Yeah, I'm just trying to build a valley. He keeps raising them up. Just raising them up by villains.
Their war with Melkor, like, causes huge earthquakes and tsunamis and, like, crazy bullshit to happen. And after elves come into the earth, they're really afraid to do battle with Melkor because they don't want to kill all the elves in a giant fucking earthquake.
That makes sense.
Melkor's a fuckboy.
Yeah, Melkor's a fuckboy because he thinks he's special.
Sort of like Satan or something.
Yeah, pretty much. Pretty like Satan.
Yeah.
Nice lost shit going in here.
Well, you know, I just thought that, like, I don't know, Melkor was, like, doing ska music when, like, Eredor was, like, doing reggae, and, like, we all want to like reggae, but, like, ska's, like...
Melkor was ahead of his time, that's the thing.
Yeah.
But wait, sorry, there's one other thing that I did want to also say. You did talk about Sauron a little bit, and Sauron was not created by Melkor. Sauron was one of the Maiar that also went down to Earth later, and he was bent to Melkor's will.
Okay, I missed that.
I don't think that this was made clear in the Valar.
No,
itself,
it just mentions that his favorite servant was Sauron.
Keenan, if I could just finish a sentence.
I'm agreeing with you, motherfucker.
I don't think this was made clear in the Valar Quenta itself, but Sauron was a...
Austin, can I cut you off real quick?
You just did.
All right, cool. So I just wanted to point out that, like, you know, why is it okay for me to cut you off and not Keenan? Like,
thank
it's
you.
It's a question of attitudes, really. Anywho, so Sauron was a servant of Aule.
I'm gonna fucking leave that right fucking there.
All right, so Austin, please keep going.
If you know Lord of the Rings and stuff, Sauron is pretty important, and you're like, oh shit, he's not the big bad boy. Melkor's the big bad boy, and I would say yes, that's exactly how it is. Sauron is the little bad boy.
The little bad boy.
The thing is, Sauron was originally like a good dude. He worked for Aule. He was a Maiar underneath him, and Aule was the guy who was like in charge of the earth and metals and jewels and like physical substances.
Oh, is that why his face is made out of knives?
Excuse me?
Is that why his face is made out of knives?
Whose face is made out of knives?
Sauron.
What?
You're talking about the movies.
His helmet, you know, it's like...
You mean his helmet?
Well, I mean, is it a helmet? There's no way to tell. Because fuck Peter Jackson, first of all. But second of all, like...
It seems like a helmet. Because it's metal.
The thing is, the Ainur can take any shape that they deem fit. Like, they can just, like, say, like, I'm going to have a body, and then they get it.
All right, here's my question. How come Sauron didn't take the shape of, like, a miasma of death? Because then he would have won that war, right?
I mean...
I don't know where the ring comes into any of this.
I mean, he kind of had kind of the shape of a miasma of death, but he was stuck in a tower because he put all of his power into a ring.
So he fucked himself.
That was dumb of him.
Yeah, no, that's actually one of the primary things in, like, Tolkien's conception of good and evil that we can talk about later, but we're out of time. Anyway, so yeah, it was like a little creation myth, right? We don't need to talk about all the names of the Ainur, because if you want to, you can read the Valaquenta, and, you know, it's a little bit esoteric. We got other shit to talk about.
You mean we're not going to talk about Manwë, the most powerful of them all?
Wait, real quick, before we exit the summary, I want to talk about Tolkis, who is my fucking hero.
Tolkis is awesome.
Wait, what?
Tolkis is the best. Okay, so there's this guy, Tolkis, and he is, like, the strongest, and let me just pull up a quote. Okay. He delights in wrestling and in contests of strength.
Oh, this guy.
And he rides no steed, for he can outrun all things that go on feet and is tireless.
His hair and beard are golden, and his flesh ruddy. I don't know what ruddy is, but it sounds sexy.
It means, like, it's sort of red.
His weapons are his hands. Tolkis is the best.
I just like the sentence that said, like, reasoning with him was just, like, not even a thing.
Yeah, no, Tolkis, his rage passeth like a mighty wind. Anyway, no.
Or what did
Tolkis
he say? Like, you don't get good advice from him? Wasn't that one of the sentences?
Is of no avail as a counselor, but is a hearty friend. He's a good guy, but he doesn't know a whole lot.
He's a good guy, but he's...
He has little heed for past or future.
Tolkis is the quintessential badass, because he was the last one to come to Arda, because he just, like, heard that Melkor was giving everyone trouble, and then he was like, oh, I better help them fuck him up. And then he came down to Earth, essentially just to help people fuck up Melkor. That's his only job.
Yo, he's the guy... No, he's the guy at the bar who overhears about someone being picked on and, like, takes off his shirt and just runs down at the end of the bar. I was like, let's go, bro.
I was just picturing, like, a luchador, but, like, with golden hair.
The bro follow. Okay, kids, so that was a roller coaster of bullshit. Let's move on to domains. Eddie, start.
Okay, well, geez. Just coming right out of the gate with it.
Thanks for the vote of confidence.
Dark Souls. It's a Western-style RPG made by a Japanese development studio from Software, and it's really cool. Dark Souls has a pretty interesting lore, and I think it's a pretty good topic for this episode of the podcast, because it does very much change the way you look at the game when you start learning about the lore, because it's not presented to you at all. You have to go find the lore of Dark Souls. So let me start detailing some of it. So in the beginning...
This sounds familiar.
In what is known as the Age of Ancients, everything was gray and unchanging.
Same.
There were these huge trees called the Arch Trees. They were also gray and unchanging. And there were the everlasting dragons with their stone scales, and they were gray and unchanging.
Wait, they move around. That's cheating. That's changing.
No, they didn't move around very much, actually.
But they still moved around. Ha! Got you. You're a liar.
Well, that's actually unclear, because in the intro cinematic of Dark Souls 1, we see a shot of an everlasting dragon, and he's not moving. So they may not have moved around. So this is the Age of Ancients. There's no time, nothing changes, everything's gray, and yeah. But then, so there's the above, which is where the arch trees and the ancient dragons are, and there's the below. And in the below, there was basically nothingness. So in the below, the first flame appeared, and nobody knows how or why, but it did. And then the first beings that inspected the first flame, they found powerful souls within it.
Were they dark?
So there's Gwyn, Lord of Sunlight. There's the Witch of Izalith, and there's Nito, First of the Dead. And then after they leave, there's one more being who finds a much smaller, much less powerful soul. And he's the Furtive Pygmy, and he finds the Dark Soul.
Oh, shit. So you're telling me that unless you go and find this lore, you don't fucking know why the game is called that?
Not at all. Well, I mean, you could guess, and we'll get to that. So so then what happened was some time passes, because time exists now. That came along with the first flame. Gwyn, he raises, like, a kingdom and, like, trains up a bunch of knights, and he has some children. The Witch of Izalith also has children, and Nito dies, and that's how he becomes the First of the Dead.
Nito keeps being creepy.
And then eventually they decide to wage a war on the Everlasting Dragons so that they can usher in the Age of Fire and rule the world.
Of course.
So they start fighting the dragons. There's this one dragon, Seath the Scaleless. Woo! And he doesn't have any scales.
Oh, shit. So he doesn't have the stone scales, which means he can move?
Well, they all start moving when the first flame comes about. So Seath the Scaleless...
Oh, because there wasn't time before then.
There wasn't time, yeah. So Seath the Scaleless, he comes to Gwyn, and he's like, hey, so I hate all the other dragons because they are all everlasting and immortal, and I'm not. So I'm going to betray them.
What a little bitch.
Hey, he was a scientist.
So he tells Gwyn the secret to killing the dragons. It's their stone scales that make them immortal. So if you get rid of the scales, you can kill them. So Gwyn harnesses the power of his Lord Soul and creates these lightning spears that he teaches his knights how to use. And they all throw lightning spears at the dragons to peel away their stone scales.
But electric is not very effective against rock.
Actually, no, it's neutral.
And then the Witch of Izalith.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
Really?
It's because there are so many rock ground types.
Yeah, I guess you're
so right. The Witch of Izalith, she and her daughters use the power of the Witch's Soul to conjure, like, storms of fire and, like, burn the dragons. And then Nito, he summons, like...
Dead things.
A miasma of death.
Wait, real quick. So everyone else is doing, like, this great stuff in the beginning, and, like... Nito just happens to die?
Yeah, something like that.
Like, he was the first, he tripped and died, and everyone was like, oh shit, what the fuck is that?
So then, basically, they kill most of the dragons. Not all of them, but most of them. And then Gwyn and his children, they become, like, gods, ruling over the other beings, which are what the humans would consider giants, is what the other beings are. And then the Witch of Izalith, she goes and creates a city down lower in the earth. And Nito, he goes and lives in, like, a grave. Because he's basically a bunch of skeletons all massed together into a big dude.
He's dead, so he hangs out with dead things.
He's pretty metal.
Yeah. And then humans start to appear. And the thing about the humans, the lords don't know this, but the Furtive Pygmy who found the Dark Soul... Instead of harnessing its power to become a lord like the other ones did, he split it into a bunch of smaller souls, and those became humans. And so humans have dark souls.
Oh, shit.
Same.
So anyway, a bunch of time passes. Everything's great, and then it's not great. The first flame starts to fade, and the lords are all like, shit, what do we do? And the Witch of Izalith tries to create a new one with her her lord soul. But it doesn't work, and it consumes her, and she becomes this, like, weird monster called the Bed of Chaos, and demons start spawning from it.
Oh, shit, that's her?
Yeah, and then eventually Gwyn is like, well, shit, there's only one thing to do now. So he goes and he sacrifices himself to the first flame and burns up so that it can burn for longer, and he tells his children to shepherd the humans... to become powerful, and then the most powerful among them, like, convince that human to sacrifice themselves to the flame so that you know, the Age of Fire can keep going. Oh, also, when the flame starts fading, the humans start becoming undead. They get this curse called the Dark Sign, and when they die, they come back to life, and they keep doing that forever and ever, and eventually they lose their minds, and that's called hollowing, and then they keep coming back to life, but they're mindless zombies now.
And you don't want to be a mindless zombie, and that's your motivation.
I know I don't.
So then at the start of the game, it's like, hey, to break the curse of the undead, you have to collect these powerful souls and link the fire. You have to relight the first flame. Uh-huh. Wink.
I thought the reason why you had to like do it because you're trying to get all the Lord souls, because the old king didn't kill himself to keep the fire going because he was a bitch.
That's Dark Souls 2.
Oh, anyway.
He was a real bitch.
King Vendrick was definitely a bitch.
So BioShock is a first-person shooter, and every one of the games I've followed have been. The first two, anyway, which are the main focus that I'm going to be talking about, and a little bit of the third one, is set in 1960, the first game, and the second game is in 1968, and it's set in this underwater city of Rapture. So basically, there was this industrial magnate, or magnate, is that how you say it?
Magnate.
Magnate, that's dumb.
Yeah, I'm going to go with Eddie on that
one. He was a tycoon of business.
Aner.
Called Andrew Ryan. Andrew Ryan was born in Russia, and he didn't like the control that the communists had.
Fucking commies.
And then he came on over to America, hoping for greater freedom, but found himself still censored. And then he also like didn't like the church and all their censorship. So he said, you know what? I'm going to make my own place. So he kind of like made a city underwater, but then slowly class struggles along with political struggles really just kind of just got him down, man.
Definitely.
The city fell apart. Also because there's, like, apparently this genetic goo inside the sea slugs that lets you become super-powered, but also insane. So slowly but surely, the city fell, and is now just kind of like a place where roaming psychopaths with knives come out and try to stab you.
Story of my life.
So then the BioShock Infinite, the third game in the series, however, is set in a different city called Columbia. Basically, in set in...
Columbia is a country?
That's a real place.
And didn't I say a city?
No, it's a country in real life.
Isn't it also a city?
Maybe. It's a city in BioShock.
Okay, it's called Columbia because there used to be an image.
Looking this shit up.
The representation of America. It wasn't just Uncle Sam. It was also Columbia. The District of Columbia is named after that.
Yeah. I was trying to derail. I'm really sorry. I'll stop.
Right. And this city of Columbia, which is in 1914, is actually a place that is kind of like idealizes American values. / religion, which is very different from the idea of, you know, Rapture was just supposed to be separate from a government and a religion. This one's all about one government and one religion.
It's crazy.
But what they kind of do that's really interesting in the game is that you don't directly find out a lot of the story. You do encounter a lot of major characters in the story, and you can kind of, like, get a general idea of what happened. But what's really interesting
general
is...
General idea?
What's really interesting is all these little, like, audio diaries you can come across that really help build, like, fill in the blanks for, like, what exactly happened. And you find a bunch of characters that you didn't even know, you don't even meet, that were crucial players in Rapture and in Columbia that really help flesh out the stories.
I'm gonna interrupt the shit out of Jeffrey.
All right, so the domain that I'm talking about is a book.
So Galatron.
Called The Covenant of Primus, which is a lore story to the Transformers universe, specifically to the Transformers Prime universe, which was a show.
What's Transformers?
So for people that don't know about Transformers, they're fucking robots that turn into cars. But
one could say they're even in disguise.
They're aliens from another planet.
Well, they turn into cars, or they transform into cars.
So anyway,
I don't think they're robots if they're aliens.
They're both.
That's canon, Austin.
Oh, they mechanized autonomous beings or something.
Anyway, so what the Covenant of Primus is basically like the Bible for the Transformers universe. It's like kind of their lore and religion. Anyway, so the Covenant of Primus. Tells the story about in the beginning there was one similar to the fucking Silmarillion. The one ended up creating two beings, and then the one kind of becomes irrelevant after that. The two beings are Primus and Unicron. Primus is basically a being of order, and Unicron is a being of chaos. They're having their little battle between good versus evil, right? And Primus, who I would put on the same plane as Iluvatar, he is not nearly as physically mighty as Unicron, that he needs to create some descendants to help him in the battle against Unicron. So he creates the 13 primes. The important ones are Prima.
Leech Maximo.
Yeah, Prima is the first one. He's kind of the boss. He's a cool dude. There's
Alchemist Prime.
Wait, what did you say?
I said Alchemist Prime.
Oh, Alchemist Prime. Yeah, he is the one. I'm not going to talk about him.
Yes!
Because he's really unimportant.
I have like 3 for 3 of some knowledge of all the domains. I'm the best.
And then the other more important one is Megatronus, who is, yes, I know he sounds familiar. He is the prime in which Megatron took his name from.
Whoa.
So, yeah, Megatronus came from.
Is there Galvatronus?
No. Anyway. So the story of the 13 primes is they go and they basically are, they wage their war against Unicron and they win.
Dude, nice.
Yeah. Oh, another important prime to mention is Solus Prime. She exists. She's cool.
Solus?
Solus. S-O-L-U-S.
So she has no soul.
No, she's got a soul. And it's not dark. She has a giant hammer. She's like a blacksmith. She's cool. So, after they defeat Unicron, they're kind of living in this world by themselves, which is Primus, actually. Primus turns into Cybertron, which is the planet that the Transformers come from.
Which is a planet by itself, or...?
Yeah, well, it's Primus.
Primus, like, the band?
What I mean is, in this creation story, is there, like, there's just Primus and there's nothing else?
Yeah, when did the universe get created?
This is not the creation story of the universe. This is the creation story of the Transformers.
That's fine.
It's pretty easy because he can just transform into the planet and he doesn't have to make it.
Yeah.
But he has to stay as a planet for like ever. Can't just like stretch his arms.
It's implied that like the energy that it took to create the 13 primes meant that he had to kind of go into this dormant state and be the planet.
Oh. That's awkward. We're walking around on your dad, man.
So anyway, yeah, they're all living on Cybertron and they're kind of like dealing with, oh, what do we do now? And we have to kind of create society or do something. Megatronus and Solus Prime end up having some sort of like weird love affair thing that exists. And in the process, he ends up killing her.
Oh, shit.
And that's kind of what sends...
Wait, time out. How the fuck does that happen?
I honestly... I don't remember.
Yeah, that's not a weird love affair. That's murder.
They get into some argument, and he ends up... Because he's got, like, his big powerful weapon is that he's got this, like, giant cannon on his arm, similar to Megatron. Yeah.
Interesting.
And he winds up killing
her. Megatron doesn't have a cannon. He turns into a gun. Don't try to fool us.
And the barrel of the gun is a cannon on his arm in his robot mode.
Whoa. Nah, I think that was Galvatron. I think you're mixing things up.
No, Galvatron turns into, like, a mortar.
Okay, Jeffrey, is there anything else that you want to add?
Yes, there is, but...
So, in Dark Souls...
Shut the fuck up! Holy shit! It's like, every time I open my mouth, you start talking.
Jeffrey, you're being really rude.
The reason that I wanted to talk about the Covenant of Primus on this episode about the Silmarillion is because when I was reading it, I noticed that there's a lot of parallels in the story, which I think largely is because they both take a lot of cues from Christianity. Like, the 13 primes are very similar to Jesus and the...
apostles?
Yeah, that. And the apostles.
And Judas.
Yeah.
Judas was an apostle.
Megatronus is very similar to Judas and Melkor, or Morgoth, whichever you want to call him, actually.
The Zealot?
Yeah. So, Megatronus, there ends up being this great, like, war between the kind of... they kind of split into two sides here. Not exactly the Autobots and the Decepticons, but sort of. But it's a little bit more gray than that. Leech Maximo is... another guy, he's like robot Loki. He's probably more evil than Megatronus, honestly.
Whoa, what? Where's all this?
He's really manipulative, and he's kind of the one who kind of steers Megatronus into this dark side.
Weren't you just saying it was all gray, and then you go on to say this guy's more evil than this other guy who's apparently evil? Come on, where's the gray, man?
It's like shades of evil, 50 shades of evil.
That means that's not gray, that's just varied shades of like darker black. Black and slightly darker black with noir and ebony.
Or maybe it's just really, really dark gray. Now, Jeffrey, please continue.
Thank you. So, after they've had this all war, there's kind of like this power struggle, and they end up defeating Megatronus, and he goes into exile and is forever known as the Fallen after that. So, I just feel like...
The Fallen? Like the movie?
Yes. There's a lot of interesting, like, kind of character parallels, because you've got, like, Iluvatar and Primus, who decide to make these beings, right? Like, the Ainur. How do you pronounce it? Ainur? Ainur.
The Ainur.
And the 13. And the Ainul, yeah.
The Ainul and the 13 brides.
They end up on this world that was created, like, I mean, I know that the one world is literally Primus, but it's basically the same kind of thing, right? And they're basically trying to form society in the image of their god. And then there's one of them who's just fucking not about it and resents the creator for being too elitist, sort of, I got the sense. Because the other thing about Megatronus is he is the 12th of the 13 created. So he really resents the primes like Prima and the other earlier ones for being closer to the image of Prima. And it's kind of suggested... Primus. That along the line they got more and more close to Unicron. So like the ones that are righteous like Prima are at the beginning, and the ones that are kind of chaotic and
evil.
Yeah, not yeah, I was gonna say rebellious. The ones who are rebellious are more near the end. Yeah. And then the ones who actually end up being the best of them are sort of kind of around the middle, honestly, except for 13. The story with 13 is that he's actually Optimus Prime, and then like takes away his memory, and then gets reborn as Orion Pax, and then later becomes Optimus Prime again, but doesn't know that he was one of the original 13. I don't know. It's really convoluted, and I don't like that part, so which is why I'm not talking about it a lot.
It kind of makes sense that the last one is the best one because he perfected the.
Prepared some questions for you.
Thank you so much, Eru.
My dude.
I'm glad you let us you took away my agency.
What is agency?
So I wanted to start by going around the table. So Eddie, I was wondering, the first time you played through Dark Souls, like, did you know about all the lore, or how did, like, learning about the lore change it for you? And, like, along with that, how does, like, reading this creation myth of the elves, does it change how you see any of the shit in The Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit in the movies or books that you've seen?
Yeah, of course. So like I said before, Dark Souls doesn't really present the lore to you. You gotta find it. Like, nobody, like, no characters in the game or cutscenes or anything tell you really what's going on. Like, there's an opening cutscene, and that's about it as far as story goes. The rest of the lore you find through, like, reading item and spell descriptions and stuff like that, and through, like, looking around at the environment and inspecting it. So the first time I played through Dark Souls, this is what I knew the story as. I was undead, and then I escaped from the undead prison, and then I killed 4 dudes, and then I killed a 5th dude, and then I lit myself on fire.
But they were undead too, so like...
And I was like, yeah, I guess that was the plot of the game. but then the way I kind of discovered, like, the lore aspect of it, which is a big part of, like, the community around the game, is I was trying to look up, like, you know, interesting other, like, builds I could try for a character. Doing this, I was looking at, like, items and their descriptions and stuff. I was reading into this stuff, and I was like, wait a minute, this seems like it's a little deeper. So then I started, like, reading, looking up my own stuff and watching YouTube videos. And when I played through the game after that, like, you know, I wanted to, like, read, like, every item description and, like, every spell. And it makes you kind of pay attention to the game in a different way, which is something Dark Souls already does with the gameplay, where, like, it's really kind of, like, unpredictable, and there's, like, traps everywhere, so, like, you really have to pay attention to your surroundings. And then once you get into the lore, you start really paying attention to your surroundings in a story sense, because there are different locations where, like, you can discern things that happened or things that relate to the lore through the environment. So something that I talked about before was Gwyn, the Lord of Sunlight. He had some children, and his firstborn son was, like, a god of war. But he betrayed Gwyn during the war with the dragons. So there's all these statues of him, but they've all been smashed. So, like, you don't know what he looks like.
Till you fight him.
In the third game, that's, like, years later,
though. Still, you fight him. Then you're like, oh, shit, that's what he looks like. Oh, God!
And I'm pretty sure in the third game, it's not the same you, so...
So you start looking into the lore, and there's the story that you find, which is like, you know, the flame is fading and like the stuff that I described before. And there's this like primordial serpent who kind of like starts guiding you, and he's like, hey, you got to link the fire to like lift the curse of the undead and like extend the age of fire, and it'll be great. And so you're like, yeah, this is the right thing to do. There are areas in the game that you don't have to go to beat the game. And some of them you won't even find when you're trying to play through the story of the game, like whole sections of the story that you have to find and fight your way
to.
And so there's this other primordial serpent who's like, that other guy is a fucking liar. So there's this whole second story that you're like, whoa. So this other serpent is like, no, don't relight the fire. Let that shit die, and you can become the Lord of Darkness. And that's,
oh shit.
And that's a good thing, because humanity has the dark souls. So you'll usher in the age of man. Your people will become the rulers of the world, and the gods will die off. And so then you're like, shit, I don't know what the right thing to do is. So that's I think, a really interesting way that the lore of Dark Souls changes your experience with how you experience the gameplay and the story. And learning about this, reading the sections from the Silmarillion, definitely like made me think of that. Because I've watched Lord of the Rings a bunch. I've read it once. You know, it's like I'm now having like different ideas about like stuff that's going on, and it also kind of like sheds some light on things.
Yeah, I think I want to ask, I want to ask Jeffrey a similar question, just like wherever I mention Dark Souls, you can put in Covenant of Primus, and then Keenan, you can wait a minute.
I think that the main thing that the lore adds to you is it's sort of giving you another story, but it's related to something that you're already invested in, which I think is similar kind of with the Silmarillion and the Lord of the Rings and the Hobbit, right? Because I kind of see like it gives you some context for the things that people talk about, especially in Transformers Prime. There are some seasons when they're going to find like a bunch of powerful items. Like one of them is the Forge of Solus Prime, right? And they don't talk a lot about who exactly Solus Prime was. They just talk about what the Forge is. So this story kind of gives us a context for like, where did Solus Prime get this Forge and yada yada, et cetera, right? And it also gives context for like character motivations, since Megatron named himself after Megatronus. So you start to better understand his ideals because of that. Because I know like one of the things for me personally that was always very confusing about Lord of the Rings, like considering that I'd only really seen the movies, was I did not fucking understand at all who Sauron was and where the fuck he came from. And though this bit of the Silmarillion didn't explain too much about where Sauron was, I already have a much better understanding of like what his character is. I think when they make lore like this, they include metaphors basically that kind of parallel with the main storyline that you're listening to. The story of what Morgoth is doing is kind of similar to what Sauron's kind of doing, right? And then the story of what Megatronus is doing is similar to why Megatron is doing what he's doing. So it kind of gives you like a better, it's sort of like a metaphor for understanding the character's motivations in the main storyline, which I think is really interesting.
Jeffrey said something really interesting that I kind of want to relate back to Dark Souls. So a huge theme of Dark Souls as a game and as a series is about like cycles and repetition. And like, you know, in the story, like Gwyn, he becomes very powerful and he links the fire to, you know, kindle the first flame. And then that's what you're trying to do in the game. And like those themes of repetition are represented also in the gameplay, where you die a lot and then you respawn and then you try again and then you die and then you try again over and over until you get it right. And I think what that kind of does is it takes that kind of storytelling convention of like, you know, having like cyclical or repeating events. It kind of takes that storytelling convention and presents that part of the story through the gameplay.
Actually, what you just said made me think of an interesting point with Lord of the Rings too, is like the kind of cyclical storytelling. It reminded me also of the fact that fucking like the whole plot of the Lord of the Rings is Frodo trying to bring this ring and throw it in Mount Doom, and that's trying to fix the mistakes of the past, where what's his name, I can't remember his name, the man who didn't throw the ring into
Isildur.
Mount Doom. Isildur, yeah.
Keenan, good bonus points.
No, sorry, I love that guy.
He's an asshole.
In BioShock Infinite, at one point, one of the famous like takeaway lines is constants and variables. There's always a man, there's always a city, there's always a lighthouse. Because in all the games, you start off with this lighthouse. That's how you found Rapture, that's how you found Columbia. And there are like these very similar themes. Like I said, one is a city below at the bottom of the ocean, where there is no religion or like attempts at government. Columbia is a city in the sky where there is lots of government and lots of, you know, religion. And I just want to say, like, to me, what lore is, and I think both everything we've said so far really like exemplifies this, lore is story that is not part of the narrative. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It's not directly like
yeah.
The story of the Valar. Valar?
Valar.
Yeah, isn't really about Frodo.
Not at all.
That isn't about Bilbo. That isn't about Aragorn. That isn't about any really of the events that is necessarily directly involved with the Lord of the Rings trilogy or The Hobbit.
Yeah, it just kind of sets it up for it.
But... yeah, that's why I asked Jeff if the Covenant was really a main part of the narrative. In what series was this? I'm sorry, which one?
Transformers Prime. And no, it's really not.
Yeah, and I know, Eddie, that the Dark Souls, like most of the mythos, is never directly talked about at all.
No, it just you're has... just it, yeah, it just has implications for what.
Yeah, you're pointed in a direction and you just kind of go
mm-hmm.
and hope you can make it. And in Bioshock, I will say that the narrative is much more closely tied to the lore. However... what the lore does in all our examples is that it expands the in-world the in-world universe, if that's
yeah. yep.
that's right, because it just makes it seem so much bigger and it really fleshes out the world. You're not just some weird like swordsman in Dark Souls trying to like kill a bunch of people. You're doing this much greater, much bigger battle, you know, kind of thing. This the Age of Fire. Do you stop that? It is such
so actually, that's can I actually cut in here?
Yeah, sure.
So one of the interesting things about Dark Souls is that, like once you start learning about the lore, you do get that feeling of like a bigger, grander scale. But then when you
yeah.
delve more into the lore, when you delve even more into the lore and get down to kind of the roots of it. What you find out is that what you do in the game and the decision that you make at the end of the game is ultimately meaningless. It changes nothing. So it's actually, that's why I wanted to bring Dark Souls, because it plays with these kind of narrative conventions with like a main story and lore, and kind of like through the way it presents it and the way it tells the story, it kind of turns some of those things on their heads a little bit. Where like, In Dark Souls, like, you think you're, like, this big hero, and that's what, like, you know, the two, like, serpents tell you, is, like, hey, you're, like, the important guy. You get to make this important decision.
The chosen undead.
Yeah, and then what you learn in Dark Souls 2 is that your decision didn't matter at all. Because if you link the fire, right, you die, the Age of Fire continues, but eventually the fire fades, you know? You just prolonged something. But if you don't link the fire, eventually another chosen undead comes along that's stronger than you, and he kills you and links the fire. So it doesn't matter. Your choice doesn't matter, which I think is super interesting.
It's implicit, I think, in Dark Souls that like linking the fire is the good thing to do, and becoming the Lord of Darkness is bad, right? Would you say? Like, that's evil, maybe?
That's up for debate, I'd say.
Okay. But I think the inevitability of like the fire, the light, the like sort of symbols of good winning out, and that seems to me kind of similar to a lot of since I mean you didn't get to read the rest of the Silmarillion.
Not at all.
What is implied in a lot of like this mythos is that like you know evil comes from good. So, because you know, like, he said, like, Melkor only became evil because he, like, was impatient to, like, create stuff in the void, and he wanted to do it, and Ilúvatar wasn't doing it, and he didn't understand why. So he was like, I want to do stuff, but I can't do it. Now I'm just going to fuck with Ilúvatar's stuff because I'm an angry toddler. And that's where evil comes from, guys. But, no, but the thing is that evil
comes from yeah. angry toddlers.
It's always, like, self-defeating. In like so it, Melkor in the end he in his attempts to fuck with the Valar and with Ilúvatar he spreads like his power too thin and he can't like he can never rule over Arda like he wants to because they can overpower him in the end and he'll get banished and Sauron puts all of his power into that ring and he says I'm sure that it will corrupt people because I believe they will be evil. And they will do the wrong thing, and it'll work to my advantage. And in the end, Frodo and Sam and people end up doing the right thing, and they bring the ring and to Mount Doom and destroy it. And like, it's this inevitability of good winning out due to the derivative and lesser nature of evil. It just seems like interesting.
Austin, that just gave me like a way deeper understanding of Lord of the Rings.
Thank you. I was just going to say that, like, the fact that we have these like much bigger discussions is what the Lord also does that I like, is that it makes the world not just you. You know, whether you're the player or you're the main guy you're following for the story, there's not just five people in the universe and three are on your side and the other seven you're trying to beat. You know, like I especially like when lore
3 + 7 = 5.
Yeah, whatever. The point is, sorry, you know, I ain't perfect, all right?
In divine musical themes, let's start with you, Jeffrey.
All right, I'm gonna go with I gotta think about this a little bit. I'm gonna go with 3 out of 5 musical themes. Okay. I really enjoyed it, but as a general creation myth, I really liked it. You know, I don't have enough bad things to say about it. I'm gonna give it a 4 out of 5. I liked it. Yeah, I'm going to give it a 4 out of 5.
Because
it was a really interesting creation myth, but what did take away from my enjoying it a little bit is that I'm not terribly attached to the Lord of the Rings series, and it doesn't hardcore relate. It relates in a lot of metaphorical ways, but it's still, like, at least for these sections, it didn't quite answer my questions about, like, oh, what the fuck is Sauron, right? It answered a little bit, but mostly that came from your description of it.
Okay, let's go to Keenan, since I finally moved your face back into my view.
I would give this topic 3 divine musical themes with just a little bit of scat. Just because I really thought it was really cool. And I did appreciate like the parallelism to like Christianity, and I thought it was very well thought out and well written. I would give it just a little bit, but I wouldn't give it more than 3, just from the fact that, like Jeff, I agree that it is so far removed from anything that like I've read about Lord of the Rings, because I've read Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit, I've watched the movies, and like it still remains, even though it has like it's the creation of everything, it still feels very distant and remote from the source material.
No, so I really enjoyed it, and the main thing I took away was that like it definitely like expanded my understanding of the Lord of the Rings universe, and it definitely made me want to read more of the Silmarillion. That said, I also know that it's probably going to be a while before I read more of it, because it's such a like dense text, I'm not like jumping at the bit to pick it back up. So because of that, I'm going to have to give it a 4 out of 5 instead of a 5 out of 5 divine musical themes. And that's my bit.
Oh, nice. Okay, so you guys are lucky. I'm going to award one of you guys the imperishable flame.
Ooh, fancy. Am I going to have to rekindle this with my own souls?
Will
eventually?
I have to raise any valleys?
No, you just sort of put it somewhere and make a world around
it. Oh, spicy.
Have fun.
But... Can I use it to help myself turn into a truck?
I mean, yeah, you sort of put it somewhere, you make the world, and then you can go into the world and just be a truck, I guess.
That's all I want.
God is a truck, a novel. by Jeffrey Levitt.
All right.
Only one of you is going to get to have your dreams of being a truck in your own world. And I'm going to have to say this time, guys, it's... Eddie. Eddie gets the imperishable.
I agree with that.
Bullshit. You always give it to Eddie.
Keenan falls into the darkness, I guess.
I've never been on an episode that Austin hosted.
Why do I always have to fall into the darkness? Just because, yeah, sure, I would make that choice
just,
in a heartbeat.
You just
but, like,
seemed
I don't
like
see
you wanted it more than
your
did, so I assumed that you would fall.
So I really appreciate this award. I'd like to thank Iluvatar and Tolkis for the strength they provided me. And I would also like to say, ask not what your podcast can do for you, but instead what you can do for your podcast. And if you guys follow this advice, you can be like me and win the Gold Star Student Award every time you appear on the podcast. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening. Once again, I'm Austin, and this week's topic was lore and the Silmarillion. You can check it out at, like, almost anywhere you can buy books. Tolkien's pretty popular, so, like...
Your local library.
Probably in your local libraries, too. I mean, you know. Anyhow, our next episode will be hosted by that son of a bitch, Keenan, and we'll be talking about BioShock.
Yeah, I will finally be hosting an episode about BioShock, my beloved game series. We'll be talking about decision-making and morality and how it's depicted in, like, geek and nerdy mediums like TV or video games.
Yeah, so if any of you are interested, read up on it before it airs on April 21st.
Or, I don't know, like, play it. Yeah.
Anywho, if any of you listening actually want to contact us, you can find us on Twitter and Facebook at Geeking Program, or email us at commongeekingprogram@gmail.com. If you're listening on iTunes, leave a review.
This episode of the Common Geeking Program was hosted by me, Austin Lupers, joined by Eddie Ryan, Keenan Kodish, and Jeffrey Levitt. This episode is sponsored by The Number 5. The podcast is created and produced by Colin Kitchen and Jeff Levitt, with this episode edited by me, Austin Lupers, and featuring original music by Colin Kitchen. If you like the show, follow us, tell your friends, or leave us a review. We hope you tune in for episode 15, and thank you for listening to this.
Jeffrey, you froze.
God.
Did I break you?
Jeffrey, motherfucking damn it. Can you hear me now?
Can you talk more about Dark Souls?
I mean, can you hear me now?
Stop
more about Dark Souls?
Stop talking. Can you hear me now?
Ask me some questions.
Oh, shit, he's back.
Can you hear me?
No?
Yeah, we can.
Okay.
Now we can.
Maybe if you're trying to figure out if you can hear me or not, you shouldn't fucking be talking.
We weren't trying to figure it out. We knew we couldn't.